This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
All right, so listen, I got some good news and I got some bad news. The good news is that now we know exactly what Janet Yellen was thinking. The bad news is that now we have to play that game again in 5 weeks. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Ann Arbor and the studios of Michigan Radio, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you along, everybody. It is Thursday today, the 17th of September, and we will begin, as I'm sure you figured we would, with the news from the Federal Reserve this afternoon on interest rates. It goes a little something like this. Can kick down the road, right? Which is to say, no rate hike because
the economy has been performing well, and we expect it to continue to do so.
But
in light of the heightened uncertainties abroad and a slightly softer expected path for inflation,
so
the committee judged it appropriate to wait for more evidence, including some further improvement in the labor market, to bolster its confidence that inflation will rise to 2% in the medium term.
All right, so it's put up or shut up time. Today in 5 words or less. Let's see if you can do it, Rizdahl. How about this? Economy's fine. Raise coming soon-ish. Not bad, right? October 27th and 28th is the Fed's next meeting, by the by. We will meet you right back here for that. Elsewhere in global capitalism today, the consolidation that we have been seeing in the cable industry continues apace. We had AT&T scoop up DirecTV, Charter bought Time Warner Cable. The latest news comes with a little bit of continental flair. Altice, which is a European cable and telecommunications company, is snapping up Cablevision. That's a TV and internet provider out of New York. Cablevision is the second U.S. cable operation that Altice has bought. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at what that might mean for consumers.
As consumers cut the cord, cable companies are losing millions of paid TV subscribers. That costs them subscriber fees and ad revenue. So many are merging to survive.
From that standpoint, it's, yep, there's another one.
Jim Nail is an analyst with Forrester Research. He says one reason why this latest deal stands out is that the acquirer, Altice, is European and is moving pretty aggressively into the U.S. market. In May, it acquired Suddenlink with 1.5 million customers in states like Texas and California. Now Altice wants Cablevision's roughly 3 million customers. That would make Altice the fourth largest cable operator in the U.S.
The days of cable monopoly franchise within a small geographic footprint are quickly waning. And the only way to survive is to become a much bigger regional, national, or even international player.
Gartner research analyst Bill Menezes expects Altice will see more opportunities for growth in the U.S. And he says the company could offer consumers something distinctive, a bundle of services called a quadruple play,
which is every kind of communication connection a household or a business could want. Television, internet, fixed line phone service, and wireless phone service. And that's essentially the bundle that Altice has been trying to assemble in other markets and that Cablevision has done to a certain extent in the United States.
But Menezes says cable operators have tried to offer cellular service before and none has stuck with it or been successful. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
The new operating system for the world's most popular single mobile phone is out. Apple's iOS 9 hit the streets this week. And one of the bells and whistles in the thing is that it lets you block online ads. And lo and behold, it took just a day after the thing was released for ad blocking apps to be among the most downloaded on the App Store, which is good for us, right? We get to read the news, check sports scores, all that stuff without all those annoying pop-ups. But if it is good for us, got to be bad for somebody else. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has that story.
So I'm in my office, I'm a reporter, and it's been a few minutes, so I need to check the news. I type in cbsnews.com, and I get this.
You want to play?
I'll give it a shot.
An ad for a video game. Enter Apple's iOS 9 and ad blocking, which will save us from enduring the same thing on mobile.
That's a great way of putting it.
Mobile industry analyst Jeff Kagan says, yeah, consumers will benefit, but
if you're an advertiser or if you're an ad agency, you're going to hate it.
Ad blocking apps already had the online publishing industry worried. But now that Apple's making it easy on mobile, publishers are even more concerned, says analyst Rebecca Lieb.
This has got the potential to change the entire economy of how the internet functions and how publishers will continue to function in the future.
Lieb says publishers, like news sites, might rely more on paid subscriptions, and advertisers might head to social media like Facebook and Twitter, where ads can't be blocked. Apple's move could also be a shot at Google, which rules the $120 billion online ad market. If so, says Carlos Kirchner of Bernstein Research, Google won't feel the impact too soon.
It's crucial to understand that the vast majority of Google's revenues are generated by Google sites.
As in search ads, which aren't impacted by ad blocking. Still, Apple is looking for advertising dollars elsewhere. Its new operating system includes a news app that lets media companies host their own ads, or lets Apple sell them for a 30% cut. And the app doesn't allow ad blocking. I'm Novosofo for Marketplace.
Equities did all kinds of moving around today when that Fed statement came out, and then they finished mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The U.S. Forest Service is breaking records this year, but not the records the agency likes to brag about. The Forest Service spent $243 million the last week of August fighting all the fires burning out west. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, for whom the Forest Service works, figures they'll spend another $200 million over the coming weeks as fire season out there gets even worse. And with fire, as with a whole lot of other industries, labor is by far the biggest expense. Regular staff and private contractors, too. Marketplace's Andy Euler picks up the story from there.
The Forest Service has burned through its budget for 2015. It's only September. Scott Vail is an incident commander for California. He spoke to me from near the Oregon border, where his team was wrapping up its shift working a fire that burned about 70,000 acres.
With the current fire situation in the West, we've stretched the capacity. So we rely on the private contractors to fill in that gap between, you know, what we have and what we need.
After all, fighting these wildfires isn't like fighting a fire in the city. A lot of times, it's in the middle of nowhere. So they've got to bring in contractors to help set up tent villages, build remote showers, and do the laundry.
I mean, we have to feed people, we have to provide their communications, so all of this stuff has to come in from somewhere else.
It's not just bathrooms and catering. Daryl Stockdale has been involved with firefighting in the state of California for about 40 years. He's the guy who manages the helicopters that come in to help, essentially air traffic control. He retired a few years ago because his cardiologist told him to, but he kept watching what was happening. Hotter temperatures, drought, more people moving closer to the forests, and he started a business.
So I asked myself, well, is that going to make for smaller fires? No. And is the are the wildland agencies contributing a tremendous amount of money to their fuels management program to eliminate the risk? No. It looks like Daryl shouldn't worry too much about the technology coming up that's going to eliminate fire anywhere in the near-time future.
So if you're working for a contractor, could you be out fighting fires every day of the week? Well, maybe for a little while, and certainly out west this year. But it's not always fire season. Kevin Cushman owns Firestormers Incorporated, a company with two fire trucks, each with three-man crews.
Fires are pretty sporadic. They take off. We took off this year, end of June. We got going, worked for about 10 days, and then we sat for about 3 weeks with nothing happening. And then these fires took off again, and then everybody got busy. So that's kind of part of the game.
Cushman says that puts contractors in an awkward spot. Your business and livelihood depend on natural disasters.
And yeah, you don't want to root for fires and, and wish for those. But when they are out there, you do hope we get called out and recoup some of that cost that we put out every year.
If you work for the Forest Service, your wage is guaranteed, but you might not be making as much money. Kyle Dickman fought fires for 5 years with the Forest Service for $12 an hour. Now he writes about fires. He's got a book out called On the Burning Edge.
I know that there's a lot of people in the Forest Service and especially the federal government that they're not too happy with all the contract crews because the contract crews, they increase the cost of the firefighting.
But Dickman says the federal government doesn't have the budget to actually hire more permanent firefighters. So it'll continue to spend money hiring contract crews when they need them.
Firefighting's already been privatized. A lot of it has. I mean, there's a lot of staff that goes into supporting wildland fires, that firefighting that, you know, that's not the actual boots on the ground work of swinging a Pulaski.
Private firefighting is a $2 billion industry. It's even got its own Monster.com equivalent that sets up would-be firefighters with agencies looking for crews. It's called Wildfire X. The slogan? The right wildland fire job is waiting. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
When we talk oil on this program, it's almost always big oil. The international drillers or things the size and scale of something like the Bakken oil field, which at its peak could literally be seen from space. But big oil is not the only oil, you know, and as prices fall, small oil, if you will, is really getting squeezed. Steve Plants is the co-owner of Plants and Goodwin Incorporated. They run what are called stripper wells out in Pennsylvania. Mr. Plants, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Maybe you could start by telling us what exactly stripper wells are.
Sure. Stripper wells are wells that, by definition, make less than 10 barrels of oil per day.
Wow. That's not a lot of oil.
Well, that's a lot for, we would love to have a bunch of them that made 10 barrels a day, but ours make, you know, and most stripper wells make significantly less than 10 barrels a day.
And how many of those wells do you have?
We have about 200 of them.
Oh, all right. So let's 200 times 10. So you got a couple of thousand barrels coming out maybe on a good day?
Right. So, I mean, obviously that's how we used to make money was by volume, not necessarily, you know, volume of wells that make a small amount each well.
So with oil at you know, 45-ish plus or minus dollars a barrel, how's business for you?
Well, it's not good. We're in better shape than some simply because we've diversified over the last 40 years, and we do a lot of other things in the oil field industry. And unfortunately, I think very telling is the biggest part of our business right now is plugging wells for other customers.
Plugging wells because they've decided it doesn't make sense for them economically to try to pull the stuff out of the ground.
Sure. I mean, and a lot of them are old wells, you know, that have their life expectancy is at the end. And, you know, they are an environmental hazard when they get that way. So, you know, companies go ahead and spend the money to plug them.
Yeah. How old are we talking on old oil wells here?
Well, I mean, we're still pumping a couple of them that were drilled at the turn of the century.
Like not the past one, but the one before that.
Yeah, like 1900, wow. 1901. Yeah.
Wow. What's your break-even price then? I mean, at what point would you say, you know what, the heck with it, we're going to plug them up and shut them in and do something else for a while?
Well, we're losing money every day right now ourselves. You know, because of the way our business is set up, we pay our people pretty well. We have full health care benefits that we pay 100% of. Our cost to operate and keep employees is pretty expensive. So, I mean, we're losing money every day at $40 oil.
So what are you doing? Are you just crossing your fingers or what?
Yeah, you know, because it's a pretty bad alternative because you can, if you decide you're going to plug them all, you know, you're somewhere in the neighborhood of $5,000 to $10,000 a piece to plug those wells. So that's a pretty good, you know, expenditure of cash that's has no chance of ever paying back.
I got to tell you, it sounds like a lose-lose deal at 40, 50 bucks.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And then, you know, when you put in all the other things that are going on right now, you know, it doesn't look good. You know, the glut of oil that's out there right now, the dollar is really strong, which is, you know, also bad for the price of oil. And weak demand, I mean, it's bad news for us right now.
How long have you been in this business, Mr. Plants?
Our company, my dad and another man started this company in 1970, and I've been involved with it since 1983.
So I imagine you've seen pretty much everything, right? You're just going to ride this out?
We've seen a lot of ups and downs. It's kind of the, you know, if you can go all the way back to when Drake drilled his well, and you can see that we're hoping it corrects itself, but we don't know how long that might take.
Steve Plants, he's the co-owner and vice president at Plants and Goodwin up in northeastern Pennsylvania. Mr. Plants, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, I can't recommend this as a business strategy, but desperate times, you know?
Seriously, we would not be here today without that lotto ticket. Before that happened, I was just kind of given up.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 65 points on this Fed day. 0.4%, closed at 16,674. The NASDAQ up 4 points, 0.1%, finished at 4,893. Did the NASDAQ, the S&P 500, down 5 points, 0.25%, ended things at 1,990. Cablevision, which Annie Baxter was telling you about, jumped almost 14%. Today, Verizon off 2% after the company said its earnings might be flat this year. Oracle dipped 4% after reporting first quarter revenue that fell short of expectations. Airlines flew higher after Barclays said low oil prices are benefiting the industry. United Continental up 6.2%. American Airlines gained 2.1%. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.19%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Our wealth and poverty team did a series last year called York and Fig, named for an intersection in Highland Park, a neighborhood in L.A. that is changing and fast. A working class part of town that's being gentrified as investors and just people with more money move in. There are some pretty standard themes that come with gentrification stories, like the one about mom-and-pop shops disappearing as rents go up. But just because they're standard doesn't mean they always happen. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark went back to Highland Park to a shop that has been able to thrive despite the changing demographics.
The store is called La Tropicana. It's a corner market, signs in the windows for lotto tickets, Western Union money transfers, skinny aisles packed with groceries. And here's a typical line of customers. First, a Latina mom with her two kids buying ingredients for dinner. A bag of dried chili peppers for $1.49. The whole transaction done completely in Spanish. Then a tattooed white guy in his 20s. Buying a jug of cold brew coffee and a gourmet deli sandwich.
Totals $18.70.
That whole transaction done completely in English.
Need a receipt?
Have a good day.
And that's how it goes. The things people buy, the language they buy them in, tell the story of a neighborhood in transition. Spanish, then English, basics, then indulgences, cheap cat food, Whiskas brand, for $6.99 a bag, then gluten-free cat food.
Gluten-free for your pet. Can you believe that? This is $16.
That's Raina Redfield. She owns La Tropicana, and even she is still a little shocked by some of the new items customers have been requesting. But she says this extreme mix of inventory...
This is a true reflection of what, you know, what the neighborhood is right now.
12 years ago, when Raina first started running this store, this neighborhood looked very different. Most of her customers back then were low-income immigrant families, mostly from Mexico and Central America.
You know, living paycheck to paycheck, depending on food stamps. So we were very, very limited with what we can offer, and, you know, we had to be really conscious of the pricing.
She carried basics: toilet paper, cooking oil, laundry detergent, whatever brand was the cheapest, and low-priced meat and produce that catered to her customers' tastes. Raina was born in Syria, but she grew up in an immigrant neighborhood in L.A. County with lots of Mexican families, and so she sold things she learned about from them. Pig's feet, chicharron, that's fried pig skin, a tropical fruit called chayote.
jicama, yuca.
A cactus called
nopales,
used in salads and juices.
I even learned how to clean the spikes off and cut them up a certain way.
But then, about 5 years ago, customers started asking her two questions she was not prepared for. Some of her regular customers came in to
ask for boxes
because they told her they were moving out of the neighborhood. Meanwhile, some new faces started showing up in the store.
Instead of people asking for a product that would be used to prepare Mexican cuisine, people were asking for something completely different. Organic milk, organic eggs, you know, gluten-free bread.
Back then, Reyna had not heard of the word gentrification. And then when she did hear people start using it, she didn't know what it meant.
I had to go Google it. But before even that word would come up, I noticed that my customers are asking for different things, and they look different, and they spoke better English.
Reyna says she doesn't want to label her customers or judge them. She wants La Tropicana to be welcoming for all. Spanish speakers, English speakers, buyers of whiskas, and gluten-free cat food.
They're, you know, supporting me and my employees, and we go home without them, regardless of who they are.
When you hear about old mom-and-pop stores closing down and gentrifying neighborhoods, there's often this talk about how they just couldn't change with the times. But it's not that simple. I've interviewed lots of longtime shop owners that lost their businesses, and like Reyna, they wanted to change with the times. But many of them lacked two important things that Reyna has. First of all, a long-term lease on their building. Because Reyna does have this, she doesn't have to worry about her rent rising all of a sudden. The second thing that's given Reyna a huge advantage, luck. Really good luck.
Good luck, California, and here are tonight's winning numbers.
I was literally in bed, and I get a text message from one of my employees.
Followed by 9.
And the only thing in the text message was just the word in capital letters, just the word boss.
And our final.
Reyna called her employee, and he told her their store had just sold a lotto ticket that won an $8 million jackpot. The way the lotto works in California, Reyna's store got a $40,000 cut of the winnings. Now, this was 5 years ago, in the depths of a recession that many stores in the neighborhood are still reeling from. And if not for her crazy stroke of luck, Reyna says La Tropicana might be in the same boat.
Seriously, we would not be here today without that lotto ticket. A week or two before that happened, I was just kind of given up. You know, I knew that I didn't have the cash flow to keep going. I couldn't get any loans. I didn't have any collateral. And then I started shifting into, how am I going to tell my girls that I'm going to be letting them go?
But after the lotto jackpot, she didn't have to let them go. She used the $40,000 to pay off most of her debts, which gave her the breathing room to plan strategically and change with the times. Today, La Tropicana has become a gathering place for her old customers and her new ones, with an espresso bar, a juice bar, a super popular deli counter.
We're just welcoming, period. Like, it doesn't really matter who's coming in that door.
And everyone I talk to inside and outside the store seems to agree.
Do you come here often?
Too often. The sandwiches are great. It
feels like you're going somewhere from different, like you're out of whatever city you're living in.
Ever since I started here, I've made a big change in the neighborhood.
There's something about it that has that, like, neighborhood originality about it.
But Reyna also sees this tension between accommodating the changes in her new customer base and not alienating the longtime customers that have supported her business since the beginning. She told me that those cactus that she learned to despike for her customers long ago, the nopales, well, a few weeks ago, she stopped selling them. Reyna's dad, who helps her out buying produce, had been warning her for months that they'd gone from selling 2 or 3 cases of nopales a week when they first opened the store to now less than half of a single case. The rest was just rotting on the shelf.
I fought it for a long time. What do you mean we're not going to sell nopales anymore? Seriously? We've always sold nopales. For a long time, I fought it. And then when he showed me the numbers, I thought, okay, Dad, all right, fine. Let's just stop selling nopales.
Was there something sad about that? Yeah.
I mean, I knew that certain customers did come in for it. And if they're here in the community, I want to be able to service them. But I had to think of it in a different way as a business, you know. It doesn't make sense for me to carry a product or buy something and then toss it in the trash.
And it's not just nopales. Over the last few years, after looking at declining sales, Reyna has stopped selling chayote and pig's feet and yuca. One day, I met a man in front of La Tropicana who's lived in the neighborhood 38 years. He passes the store every day. He says he likes the way it's been upgraded lately.
Más elegante,
more elegant, much nicer. But he says he doesn't shop there anymore.
No, ahorita no, porque ya no vende chicharrón.
They stopped selling chicharrón, he says. So there's not much left there for him anymore. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
So, if you can't beat the odds with a big lotto win, how do you stay in business? The answer on the latest episode of our newest podcast, it's called York and Fig, and there's a link to it at our homepage, it's marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, it's Broncos at the Chiefs tonight on Thursday Night Football. And if recent history is any guide, we are going to be seeing lots and lots and lots of ads for the fantasy sports sites DraftKings and FanDuel. They made a big push during the opening weekend last week. How big, I hear you asking? Well, how about this big? According to the Wall Street Journal, DraftKings alone aired 5,800 30-second spots in the week leading up to last Sunday. That is the equivalent of 48 full hours of ads. I did the math. All righty, got to go. The Dow Industrial's off 65 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 4 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 dropped itself 5 points lower, about 0.25%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. Thanks again to the staff here at Michigan Radio. They put us up during their pledge drive. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back tomorrow in L.A. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.